this meeting of the House Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Committee to order. To begin with, we have the minutes from yesterday's meeting. The chair would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney has moved approval of the April 15, 2015 minutes of the committee. Any additions, corrections, questions, or other inquiry about those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from yesterday, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are approved. Members, in your packet, there was one individual or group that wanted to testify yesterday, Common Cause Minnesota. There's a flyer or a letter, actually, in here about their position on the bill. Just want to bring that to your attention. With that, I believe we are in the middle of amendments to the A15-0452 delete everything amendment. Members, any more amendments?
Mr. Chair, you'd be pleased. I'd like to move the A16 amendment so you can finally clear it off your desk.
I've got to find it.
Yes.
Okay. I'm thinking step. Oh.
It should be in members' packets, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Pinto moves the A16 amendment. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, this amendment, let's see, the delete all takes a program that I gather has existed for quite a while, which is reimbursing counties for $500,000 for expenditures for court-ordered counsel, for public defenders or for attorneys that are appointed in criminal cases. And reimburses those costs. It also, I should note, reimburses counties for the preparation of local impact notes. I guess the point about public defenders and court-ordered counsel is of particular importance to me and my work, as the committee's aware, as a prosecutor with Ramsey County of domestic and sexual violence. And so this one kind of jumped out at me in particular as one that was concerning. I'll maybe just ask initially if there was a... So this language, the changes to county program aides to some extent came out of a bill that was authored by Representative Backer, but I noticed that this language was not in that bill, and so I guess one question I had for the chair is if there's a particular reason for including this cut of $500,000 to county program aid for these public defender and court-ordered counsel services.
Yes, Representative Pinto. As a matter of fact, as we were looking at areas that we could consider in order to meet our cut target, we were asked to, and it's not an official target, but the ballpark that I was asked to consider, this is one of the areas that we considered, and that's why it appears in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if, so I have concerns about sort of the public safety implications. Maybe as an initial matter, Mr. Chair, I believe there's someone in the audience who wants to testify regarding this change. Mr. Kevin Kyer from the State Board of Public Defense, if I'm saying that correctly. And so I don't believe that the board was aware of this provision. They just wouldn't necessarily be looking line by line in the property tax bill. But over this past day or two, as I've been concerned about this, I reached out to that office, and I believe Mr. Kyer would like to just testify, and I guess I would have some questions for him as well, with the chair's permission.
Mr. Kyer, are you here? Thank you. I do understand, Mr. Kyer and Representative Pinto, that they are addressing some of this in the public safety bill. So, Mr. Kyer, maybe in your testimony, anything sure. You can share about that would be good. Mr. Kyer.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. The provision that you're all talking about or that Representative Pinto is addressing is a long-standing provision in the property tax bill that we worked out with the counties, I want to say 15 years ago, maybe longer, about emergency situations that arise where we can't handle the cases for whatever reason, and I'll give you a couple of examples. Either where we have long-term vacancies or where we have cases that are just overwhelming. And what happens is we don't have the ability to refuse cases. There's court decisions on the state level that don't allow public defenders to refuse cases. So if we get somebody that leaves, particularly in a rural area where we got a lot of our folks are part-time, we've got to bring somebody in to cover those calendars, or we've got to bring somebody in to handle these cases. couple of good examples. We just had a major white-collar crime case where we had two co-defendants up in Aiken County. Our folks are not experienced in white-collar crime. There's no way we could have provided adequate defense. So that was an example where we could bring somebody in. We usually pay them by the case. We get a very reduced, reasonable rate on these cases. And they were able to come in, resolve that case without us taking somebody off of the regular court calendar, in this case in Aiken County. Some of you that have been around long enough, you remember the Jerry Hofsling, Officer Jerry Hofsling in Minneapolis. We had seven co-defendants in that case. We used this fund to be able to farm those out because of the conflict situation that arose, because we couldn't handle all seven of those. We took one, farmed them out to six private attorneys. So that's why that has been in here. As I said, I'd have to look. It's at least 15 years that it's been here.
Mr. Kyer, so what do you understand about what public safety is doing with your budget there in reflection of this item?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of reflection of this, we're still going to have those emergency situations. Right now, we're at about 65% of the attorney staffing that we should be based on state and national standards. The House and Senate both have bills that are addressing that. Depending on which bill ultimately passes or whatever ultimately goes, we probably will get to maybe 69% over the next biennium. So we're still going to be at less than 70% of where we should be based on state and national standards.
So, Mr. Kyer, they're giving you an increase in the public safety bill. How much is that increase over the current biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to go back and look. I think in the House bill, I want to say it was maybe 7% over the 2 years.
What is that as a dollar amount, Mr. Kyer?
I don't have that with me. I certainly can get it for you. I get it for staff.
Okay.
So.
Thank you. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, a couple. When you talk about the standards, the 65% of standards, 69% of standards, can you give a sense of what you're talking about there? What do you mean by that?
Sure.
In the reality of...
Sure.
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, what we do is we have, in our caseload, because people do multiple cases, in other words, they do felony cases, they do misdemeanor, they do juvenile cases, we break that down into a case unit, which is roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. Right now, our staff handles somewhere around 620 case units in a given year. The standard is about 400. So if you think about it in the context of, if you're thinking there's, somewhere between 1,800 and 1,850 hours that you'd work in a year given holidays and vacation, you're talking about somebody putting in about 3 hours per case unit, if not less, for every case that you have. That includes sex crimes, it includes homicides, it includes everything. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it does. And then let me think. So that addresses then sort of the regular situations, and sounds like it's essentially 50% higher than 400 units a year recommended, which I have to say as a prosecutor seems pretty high to me to begin with, but then this is 50% above that. Can you describe then the contrast between that kind of those regular cases versus these emergency situations that this fund in statute is intended to address?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pinto, this originally came out of, again, years ago, where we had a RICO case that came out of the Stillwater prison. And I'm talking, this is now at least 20 years ago, where we had 43 co-defendants in a drug smuggling case. There is no way the 10th Judicial District, we didn't even have 43 lawyers in the 10th Judicial District at the time to be able to deal with that. Again, we get a lot of those cases where, I'll give another example up in the 9th District where we had one of our own staff who was involved in a victim of a crime. There's no way that any of those lawyers could handle that case. So those are the kind of things that get farmed out. As I mentioned, the white collar one, the most recent one we had in Aiken County. The problem that we have is, particularly in greater Minnesota, we have almost half the counties where we're not there for first appearance. Mm-hmm. So when you come in for a bail hearing, if you come in on your first appearance, we don't have a lawyer there. Frankly, that's not acceptable to us. But that's just the staffing problems that we have. If you have that situation and now name the county, Wilkin County, wherever it is, now comes up with this kind of a homicide case, a big sex offender case, whatever it might be. We have nowhere to pull people from to be able to handle that case, particularly if they're part-timers, because they're trying to run a business on the side, and we have no ability to respond to that. So what happens is the court shuts down, or we have to pull somebody off, and then everything backs up.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you talk about then the Constitution? I guess a big concern that I have with this, just as a prosecutor, is the constitutional implications of this, that the defendants that I charge have the right to have counsel, have qualified counsel. I guess I'll just say it makes my job as a prosecutor significantly easier. It makes the process work much better, just much better for the taxpayer, for the defendant, for everybody to have a well-qualified attorney. But of course, fundamentally, I guess what I want to ask you about is especially just the right that somebody has and the concern that without this funding and support that we've got constitutional rights that are being threatened by this.
Mr. Kyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, we certainly do. I think on top of that, what obviously is a very important issue is we have an issue of, let's say we have to have somebody now on that case, that big case comes along. We pull them off. There is nobody, as I said, to cover a calendar. So what happens is that calendar shuts down in whatever county it might be. Because right now, you know, you go to an Elk River, for example. I was up there not all that long ago. Court stopped four different times during the day because we don't have enough public defenders to cover each one of those courtrooms. Now imagine taking somebody out of that rotation because now they're working that homicide case or they're working that sex offender case, and so now the court stops again. And it literally, especially in the smaller counties, is a huge deal. As I said, most of our defenders out state or out in rural Minnesota are part-time. So they don't have that ability to hand off cases, if you will, or to juggle those.
Thank you, Mr. Currier.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I mean, justice delayed is justice denied, right? And you've talked about shutting down the calendar. And I guess then can you talk about the effects on victims and witnesses, including, I mean, I'm thinking of police officers and others, but of course, fundamentally victims of crimes, when then they have to wait for their day in court because there's not a qualified lawyer to represent the defendant.
Representative Pinto, I feel like we're in the judiciary. We are in the property tax committee.
And Mr. Chair, I guess in a way that kind of makes the point. Maybe I'll just ask Mr. Kyer this. When the increase in funding was being discussed in public safety, was this cut in property taxes discussed as a part of that? I'm guessing the answer is no, because you didn't know about this until right now. Was that something that was discussed as being taken into account by the Public Safety Committee when they did discuss that other funding increase?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, it was not. This is, as I said, this is the first that we've heard. We probably should have been more diligent, but frankly, it hasn't been an issue for quite some time.
I'm curious about the amounts, and Mr. Carter, I'm very surprised you don't have those committed to memory. Because if I were you, I would know those.
Maybe I'll dig them up.
If you could, that would be helpful. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I guess the concern that I have, Mr. Chair, then, is that I understand I'm very concerned about having public defense and court-appointed counsel being cut for the reasons that I've described. And as you can tell, I have a real particular concern about this, just thinking about the cases that I handle outside the legislature. And I guess I understand that there's been an increase in funding in public safety, but I'm thinking, just logically, because this was not brought up in that committee, that the members of that committee believed when they were increasing funding on the one side, it would not have occurred to them that this would be cut. This was not something that was brought up, not something that was discussed. It may well be that increase would have been bigger to take this into account. So I guess, getting back, Mr. Chair, to your point about this not being the Public Safety Committee, I think that's right, but this provision clearly has big public safety implications. And maybe my question for Mr. Kyer is do you, in fact, because you've got extensive experience in this area going back years, do you believe that this provision does, in fact, have public safety implications, Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, it absolutely does. Just to address this really briefly, we are very judicious in using this funding. We get several requests during the year from our chief public defenders. It goes through a whole process of chief public defenders applying for it, going to our state public defender, then in this case, him determining, is there an emergency here? Is there some other way we can cover that? Frankly, in the metro area, it's easier for us. As I said, as we get into greater Minnesota, it's very, very difficult for us to do. We can't hire permanent staff with it. It was all contract. Typically what we do is we pay a lump sum to people. We get an agreement for them to handle a high profile big case for a maximum amount of money. So we're not paying by the hour. If we do pay by the hour, and I don't know how many you've hired lawyers in the last few years, typically we pay $50 or $60 an hour. The last time I needed a lawyer for my family, it was $175, and I was getting a break from one of our part-time defenders, and that's 4 or 5 years ago. So the value is just incredible in terms of what this means, in terms of keeping court calendars running, in terms of addressing public safety issues. And I think we use it very judiciously.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm wondering, given the public safety implications, I don't know how this would work procedurally, but is there some, I'm just concerned about the implications of this, that if the chair and members would support my amendment so we just don't deal with this, or to somehow have it be reviewed by public safety. I don't know if, presumably the bill would not be directed in that way. I'm in my first couple months, I'm figuring this out. But I'm just concerned with this language that there are these big public safety implications. I don't know if the chair would be amenable to, you know, to accepting the amendment so we could simply not have to worry about those, or if there's some way to direct this in some way to public safety. Mr. Chair, is any
Representative Pinto, the Public Safety Committee has an increase in this particular area, and Mr. Kyer came here and doesn't have the actual number. I don't have the actual number. I do know they had the increase because I had some discussions with them.
Right.
And the intention was for them to cover in their committee the amount that they intended and expected was the right amount for the public defender, including the regular coverage as well as all their emergency coverage and any coverage or uncoverage or any other coverage that they might see in their purview as a committee and the expertise that they have. And the desire was to remove this item from the Property Tax Committee, as they are the committee that handles public safety and judiciary stuff and not us. So that's the idea around the amendment. I trust what they have is the amount that they believe is the right amount, because that was the understanding that they were going to handle it completely and not us handle it here anymore. So that's why we have it in the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it sounds like that was a discussion between chairs. I guess my concern is that the committee, Public Safety Committee as a whole, would know that there was, and would think that as they were voting for X amount of increase, they think that there's this other piece and not realize that, in fact, there's a net increase that is, you know, less than they voted for. I guess that's the concern that
I have. Representative Pinto, that was the discussion, is that we were going to zero this item out.
Okay, between chairs, not in,
yes.
Not in, okay, between chairs,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, so given that, I guess I'm, as I say, I continue to be concerned about it, and so I guess I would ask for members to vote yes on the amendment, recognizing the need, and really that this really is a different situation. Public safety is addressing these number of units a year, and as I said, we're only going to be raising that to 69% of standards. This is separate emergency funding, which has been done through county program aid for apparently the last 15 years. And so I guess I would urge members to be supportive of the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Members, any other discussion on the A16 amendment? Thank you, Mr. Kyer. Appreciate your help here.
Thank you, Mr. Kyer.
Okay, thank you. With that, I would
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair, it occurs to me we have to have a vote. I want to ask for a roll call.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Roll call is noted, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I'm just curious, Ms. Schill or Ms. Dalton or somebody, does anybody have a history of how long this and what was and why we have this public defender aid in as part of the CPA component? Does anyone know? Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, the county program aid formula actually went into effect in 2004, and the offset went into effect in 2005, and it was to it was related to some special defender costs related to, I believe it was a county was having a bunch of look at child abuse cases in family daycare centers, and it turned out a lot of them were not true, but they had a lot of court cases related to that, and I think that was the impetus behind this.
So the idea at the time of this coming out of the tax area, the property tax area, and the county program aid area specifically, was that those were county type things, and the counties initiated that inquiry or that, and decided to somehow give up their portion of. How did that happen?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it was so much that. It was just that we had some counties that had just incredibly unusual public defender costs, and it was going to lead to some fairly substantial levy increases in those counties to pay for that, and so this was seen as a way to help those counties. And instead of doing it as a one-time thing, there was some recognition that this could be an ongoing problem for any small county. That if you're a small county and you have a murder, a very sensational murder, or like the St. Cloud area when they had the kidnapping of Jacob Weatherly, there could end up being a lot of additional public defender costs that had not been budgeted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, and I think that court-appointed counsel generally is, that is a cost borne by the counties, if I'm correct about this. So the idea would be sort of like counties have a regular cost for this, but when you have these extreme cases of child abuse or abduction or the white-collar thing that was described or whatever else, that those are cases where suddenly the county is taking on this massive one-time liability, and this is funding that supports the county doing that. And I guess I should note that I think Ramsey and Marathon and the big counties wouldn't need this because they've already got regular, it's kind of, there's enough going on, they can kind of, you know, ride it out. But for those small counties, this is a one-time thing that doesn't happen very often, and this is helping those counties to cover those costs, because otherwise they have to, I guess, raise property tax, you know, they have to pay for it somehow, and their main way they pay for it is using property taxes. I don't know if the staff could comment on if I've described that accurately, or if that's okay with the chair.
Yes, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, yes, I think that's actually a fairly accurate description of what's going on.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chair,
Representative Pinto.
I guess, yeah, so from that perspective, too, as I think about it, this really is tied in with a number of other things in terms of recognizing this is taking care of greater Minnesota and taking care of the whole state and helping counties to cover these costs that will occasionally pop up in these really tragic and difficult circumstances. Because one thing we can't do is have the counties not provide counsel. Then we get into these situations where there are constitutional problems, delays, and that ends up being really bad for victims and others as well, in addition to defendants. So I guess I would urge, so given all that, I think it's squarely within our committee's purview to simply leave the law as is and have this continue. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to bring up, and I guess Representative Blabney is here now, but we all have a lot of different committees going on, and when roll calls come up, you know, members are going to be coming in and out of the room. I'm hoping the chair would allow members, if, you know, a roll call, that we get all the members before we vote. I mean, on both sides. I know taxes, I think, is going on. Education finance is going on, which I'm on also. But if we do have roll calls, is that all right?
I think that's a good idea. Okay. On my part, we can maybe, if we're ready for a roll call, do we want to recess 2 minutes while staff goes and gets everybody? Is that what you're suggesting?
I guess so, Mr. Chair. Yes, yeah. Something so everyone has a chance, because we're all over the place today.
Okay. Are we done with this one on the discussion?
Done for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is everybody here? I know Representative Lucheski's here. Is she, can staff get her?
She's
while
in Ways and Means.
Oh, Ways and Means.
I was too.
I don't know where that's
I was too.
Well, then you know where it's meeting.
It's in... Room 10, yeah. Can somebody find Representative Lancheski? Do we GOP members? 2, 4, 6.
We'll try here a minute.
Okay.
Is Representative McDonald is
So, Mr. Chair, we're in recess.
We'll just not officially, but we'll just let's hang out while let's give him a minute to find Representative Lancheski.
Representative Dabney will give us a
twin
square. I think they're
there. Oh, are they? Hold on, I'll get back to you.
Little change in the lineup. What's the other team's record? I would like the full details, please.
So, Representative Marquardt, can we? I mean, I don't want to wait. Like, let's query the room, and if she's available, bring her up.
Exactly. Okay. If she can make it, she can.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dabney.
The Twins are up 5-3, bottom of the fourth, over Kansas City again.
A trend.
A little premature to make that statement, Mr. Chair, but you know, we'll take our bullpen will fall apart, some of the cynics here in the corner say. It's a round corner, but it's still a corner. So thank you, Representative Hurtas. It's the best part of my day so far. Well, there's two amendments in K-12. And then this.
In 2 years, Representative Pinto will be giving us a soccer league score.
No, thank you.
From the middle of that cornfield, Representative Pinto.
That's right.
So, members, we do have some time carved out tomorrow if our debate goes past today. I'd like to get done by today if we can, and that'll be really up. I don't know that the majority has any amendments, so it's really, you know, whatever we have here today. Otherwise, we'll be meeting tomorrow at 11 in 500 South.
That will change everything.
What's that?
That will change everything if we're in.
We'll do good.
Okay. That's good.
Are we ready to vote?
Yes, I think. Right.
Well, our staff is not back with a report on Representative Lancheski's whereabouts.
Okay. We'll wait another minute. Okay. I should negotiate better, Representative Dabney. It should be like, you know, one less amendment for every, you know, a minute or something.
It's a little late on that. It was striking at the beginning of K-12. I addressed Chair Loon and said, you know, I've just got a concern because she'd already said something about other committees are meeting and people are in and out. And I said, you know, I'm supposed to be in property taxes and Representative Marquardt. And then I started going around the room. Yeah, six. Representative Kwan? There's six members of K-12 Finance are also on this committee. Because I just started to say, oh, wait, Representative Hurtas, Representative Palm, Representative Erickson.
You have to go.
Lots of folks.
Okay,
Representative Anderson, big overlap.
Let's do that. Let's vote and we'll hold it open for Representative Lancheski, okay? The clerk will call the roll and we'll hold it open.
Chair Duskowski?
No.
Vice Chair Kwan?
Nay.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Hurtas?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Lancheski? Representative Lean?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Simonson?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Whalen?
No.
Representative Joachim?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, staff indicates that Representative Lancheski is not able to get away, so we can close the roll if that's
okay.
Your preference. Clerk will close it up then. Thank you. There being six ayes and eight noes, the amendment is not adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto's amendment gives an opportunity to ask to look at a few related issues. I had some extra time to review the bill since from the time we adjourned last night, and I've noticed that there are a number of provisions that were included in the division report but were never heard by bills leased in the division. And if I understand correctly, the provision that Representative Pinto just attempted to amend was not heard in any committee. And so I guess I'd like to better understand on these different provisions what your rationale was to include them. I think we all share a value of transparency and accountability to the public. You've spoken very articulately about the importance of government accountability to the voters. And obviously, transparency is the key in that relationship. If voters can't see what we are doing, they can't hold us accountable until the end. There's no way for them to intercede. I know that the folks from BOMA, the building and owners and managers, and NIOP, which is an acronym I can never remember what it means, but it's the big shopping mall folks, is how I think of them, have talked to me a number of times over the years when I was chairing about greater transparency in the property tax process, and particularly in the truth and taxation process. How do we get more folks involved? Because most years, most communities hold that required truth and taxation hearing, and one person shows up, regardless of the size of the community. And can we move it back in time to a point where they not only would be able to impact the levy, but maybe they'd be able to impact the budget that creates the demand for the levy? But that's about opening up the process and ensuring that people can see what's going on, mm-hmm. are notified, are aware. So can you just, I don't know if this was questioning that occurred while I was out of the room in K-12, but the proposed cut to public defenders had not gotten a hearing and had not, as I understand, been a bill.
That had not, Representative Dabney, and the part about the local impact note had not, I don't believe, either. That is going to be included in the state government finance bill. Those are two really strictly budget-motivated changes. And there's probably a few other small ones like that. And I agree with you, and you know, the answer to that is that we are hearing the A15-0452 amendment and all the provisions in it. We heard from 20 or more testifiers yesterday for about 11 hours. We're going to meet today for as long as it takes, continues to stay open for anyone to talk about any provision in here. And if they want to talk about one again, they're free to do that. And so the process is free, open, and transparent, and the sunlight is shining into our 106-page amendment right now.
All right, Mr. Chair, I've got kind of a mixed relationship with local notes. I think anyone who's had a local note on a bill of theirs has, at best, a mixed relationship when it comes to local notes and the process there. Can you help me better understand your provision there, please?
Yeah, as I understand, Representative Dabney, our leadership has in the House has made some sort of agreement with leadership in the Senate to develop a new legislative budget office that will coordinate many of these things, and that will be within the state government finance bill. And so local impact notes and their responsibility are within that, so no longer necessary for us to have it in our bill.
So GOP leadership in the House has reached an agreement to grow state government. That's kind of, you know, man bites dog.
If a dog is fighting with another dog, don't put your hand in there, is what I've been told. Or dog bites man.
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's that. Hold on, let me write that down. That's good counsel.
I was working with that.
I could see the wheels turning, Mr. Chair. I could see the wheels turning.
Yeah, and I don't know what the numbers are, Representative Dabney, about that budget office. I just know that that was the agreement, and that's what's going to happen. And I took my orders from headquarters.
As you know, state government is a three-legged stool. Two legs on a stool make it awfully wobbly. Has your leadership engaged the governor's office? Because I think I've seen some at least media reports where he questions the need for a nonpartisan budget office. I appreciate, you know, the
questions behind it. We've all had that moment where we say, what the heck? That cannot possibly be that. You know, it can't cost that much to do this provision. And sometimes things mysteriously change, sometimes up, sometimes down. But what can you share with not only the committee and the public here about your leadership's conversations with the administration on this issue?
Not much, Representative Dabney, because I don't know much about that. I will also add, as we look forward, I know Representative Lancheski has some amendments that she hasn't brought forward yet, and I offered to her we would not close up the bill until she had a chance to bring those forward. So if that's helpful, and we'll want to make certain that maybe staff brings her up for those before we're done here today, if we're done today, Representative Dabney.
I appreciate that. Continuing on, but I do recognize that even if the House and Senate leadership agree to this provision for the creation of a budget office, I'm still pretty clear the governor's signature has got to be on there before it happens. Although, would we be able to restructure our spending in a way that created an office without the administration's approval? The two bodies have budgets, right?
I don't think we could, Representative Dabney.
Why not?
Because that would require our budgets are. You mean our budgets within our appropriation?
What I'm thinking about is the whatever the budget is that the House has for its functioning, and the budget that the Senate has for its functioning. I would imagine we've got a pretty high fence around that from the administration. Balance of powers, you know, separate autonomous branches of government. We're not going to want the governor's office telling us how to spend our money as the legislature. So couldn't we create such a body, such an office, just by reorganizing our spending and without having to go to the governor for his approval?
Ostensibly.
Ms. Schill is grabbing your microphone, which is a universal sign of I can say something here that would help.
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I know very little about the negotiations for the proposed legislative budget office, but it would be in one of the joint agencies and not housed in either the House or the Senate. It would be in with the joint agency. I have not seen any budget numbers. My colleague who works with state government finance has seen that. We can get that kind of information. But I would just remind you, as with any appropriation, it must be law. There must be an appropriation in law before spending can occur. And so you ask it, you know, what kind of control, and can you do it within the House budget? That's not the plan. The plan is for a joint agency, and I'm not sure exactly how it is structured. And if you need more information, we can get you that information.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just occurred to me that once the new Senate office building is done and the Senate moves out of their rental space on the first floor, there's room. There's space. I was hoping for a racquetball court, too, but I mean, I may not get that. That's probably in the Senate office building.
Maybe we could repeal that space kind of like we do the commercial industrial portion of this general somehow, Representative Dabney.
You know, interesting idea.
Discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
You also have a provision in here related to pipelines that, again, did not, was to, as I understand it, not introduced as a bill, not heard in any committee. And I'm wondering if you could explain the provision, since the committee did not have the opportunity to walk through the bill in a regular hearing, and then also why inclusion at the last minute without the traditional public process.
The pipelines provision was in the author's amendment, and I outlined that yesterday morning, the fact that it was not in the bill, and that that the discussion on the author's amendment would serve as the hearing for that. And we actually had testimony from the Association of Minnesota Counties about that. And so it served actually very well as a hearing for it. We can go back to that and review it if you would like to. I don't know if Mr. Hilgard is here today, but he did cover it pretty well yesterday morning. And it requires the agreement of both the pipeline company and the counties in order to happen. So a very low-level controversy, if any.
Well, Mr. Chair, you haven't met my constituents, where anything having to do with pipelines is controversial, where we're in an interesting jam-up, literally and figuratively, when it comes to the railroads and their transportation of hazardous products, particularly oil out of the Bakken to our west by rail. We're also in a bit of a jam-up on the transport of that oil through pipelines, or shale oil out of Canada through pipelines through Minnesota. And there's safety issues, there's water quality issues with both methods. And I end up with constituents who are awfully concerned about both and don't find any provision regarding either railroads transporting hazardous materials or pipelines transporting hazardous materials to be anything but controversial.
Yeah, this is existing pipelines and the property tax around them, mm-hmm. and that's all that it deals with.
Okay. Then the school credit, you've been working hard on the issue of the impact of school capital levies on ag land, and I certainly understand that. But again, you've had some different iterations in the past. The interaction with the income tax is a new one, and again, it didn't get a full hearing, this iteration of it, and I was out of the room early yesterday, which is why the question about the pipeline, because I don't think I was in the room during the discussion on that provision. I think I had to be elsewhere. But I don't think I missed a conversation about the proposed ag school capital levy credit. And why the income tax, and I guess, well, first of all, why not a full public hearing before inclusion in the bill?
Yeah, again, Representative Dabney, we're having that right now, and it's in the bill, and we took over 20 testimony from 20 or more people. I didn't count them up, but it was a long list of folks yesterday. There's a bunch here today that are welcome if you would like to talk about that provision, or if you would like to talk about it, or if anyone else in Minnesota would like to come and talk about it, now's the time. And we talked about it yesterday for 11 hours. And so if you have any specific questions about it, I'm willing to offer any thoughts I have about it. Anyway, we're fully hearing it right now.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the concern is, six of us, or five of us on the committee are missing from the hearing room because the K-12 Finance Committee is meeting right now. And so the folks who are focused on education funding, but be it state funding or local levies, be it general education formula or policy around capital levies and the like, are probably watching the K-12 bill come together and then aren't available here. And I'm not making any accusations of anything except a tough schedule here, but it does dim the light of day when the folks who are most concerned about this are probably in a different committee and not able to be here to help us better vet this proposal.
Okay. Any questions for me or for anybody else on the committee about the bill? Any other thoughts, any other amendments? We do need to get Representative Lachesky's amendments yet. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment here, but before I offer it, I would like to ask a couple questions on the ag credit, on the school bond levy, and I would like to ask a couple questions on the taking away that first year of CI from the state general levy, and I'm just wondering if that would also eliminate it from local property taxes. In essence, is that going to present any sort of shift on the county or the state or the school district level for other property taxes?
My understanding is none whatsoever, but we'll turn that question over to Mr. Hines.
Mr. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. This change in the treatment of CI property only is with regard to the state general levy. There's no change being made with regard to the local tax, local levies.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is something I was thinking about yesterday as we were going through this, and after the hearing last night, I thought I would like to offer an amendment. It's the A38 amendment, and I will move that amendment and ask for a roll call. But basically, what it would do is take some of the proposed cut to the state on the CI side and put that into ag property taxes. And so basically, it would grow what's eligible for homestead ag property tax refunds. Right now, of course, the house, garage, and 1 acre is eligible for the property tax refund, and this would basically take all of what's considered to be a homestead ag property and make it eligible for the refund. And I wanted to offer this to build off of what you had done for the credits on the school bond levy and everything. And Representative Marquardt and I, and Senator Eakin for that matter, we had a couple meetings with some farmers in Clay County, and you know, we heard, well, we put forward to them various different proposals, whether it was credits or refunds or just credits on the actual value of the ag market land. And what we heard from them was, you know, we appreciate you guys thinking about this. This is good stuff, but it really doesn't address the real systemic issue, what's going on here. They over and over again said, you know, this is just a short-term Band-Aid. This is a Band-Aid. And I get that. And I think we do have to take a further look at possibly moving from, I know we heard testimony on this earlier in the committee, but possibly moving from the market-based assessments onto a production or a use-based assessments, whether that's based on soils, the way other states do it, whether it's based on just acreage and crop prices. I think that's kind of the way North Dakota does things. And so, you know, I do think at least taking another look at that, it's been some time since 91 to at least take another look at how that may work in Minnesota is something that, you know, we should really think about. And I am, I have been researching that here this year and am working on a bill, so I hope I can get that in here by a deadline so we can get moving on that this session. But in the meantime, basically, this amendment would provide some, as the farmers said themselves, some short-term relief, building, of course, on top of your school bond credit, school bond levy credit, and so that's the gist of the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lane, and roll call has been noted on the amendment. Representative Lane moves the A38 amendment, and a roll call has been noted. Representative Marquardt, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I do like and appreciate the portion you've got in the bill on the school debt. I mean, that we, Representative Lee and I, we had a couple meetings with the farmers in Clay County, and there's probably 30 there at each meeting. And that's, the school issue is certainly a concern. There's no doubt about that. But as Representative Lee mentioned, it's kind of, the biggest concern was the market values. And how that the market values rising have no relationship to, of course, the commodity prices going down from $7 corn to $3.80 corn. You know, I mean, it's just, it's a huge difference. And so what they brought up is there's something kind of a little more long-term that would match the income. I mean, kind of the commodity prices with property taxes, kind of. And Representative Leans is really using the current system we have to match income with property taxes. But what was kind of interesting, Mr. Hines was a great help, is as we were meeting with these farmers in Clay County, we were trying to look at, were there other efforts ever in Minnesota that looked at kind of this income production, where you would look at different types of land and average out commodity prices over time and somehow give land a factor based on that. And Mr. Hines did find a report that was actually done in 1991. And during the farm crisis in the 80s, there was like three reports that had been done, or kind of task force, but never got to too far. And then 91 was this full-blown report. I think, was that the Department of Revenue? Okay, that was Department of Revenue. But it's kind of interesting. I'm going to give you a quick little quiz. In Clay County, because I don't remember all of them, but What do you suppose was the average price per acre back in 1991? Clay County, I don't know how that compared with, but I mean, compared to what they are.
I'm going to guess $650.
Representative Skowski, you are right on. That's 650. I think it was a dollar up or down.
Which other county do you want to know?
I will tell you what, on the House floor, I will never, ever ask you a question that I know for sure you don't know, because that is really good. So, I bring that up to the meetings that we have with the farmers, and they never even, some would say, $900, $1,000 or whatever, but right on, it's $650 in Clay County. So you can see how things have gone. But one of the things from the study that showed is that if you went to that approach, and is that it actually cut ag land property taxes by about 22%. Of course, it shifted. They didn't have anything else on. And so I don't know how, well, I know it didn't go very far, but that was kind of the last report. So maybe long term, even building off of what Representative Lean is doing, is looking at, rather than a market value approach when it comes to ag land, is because a lot of states, as we kind of did a survey, Representative Lean and I did a survey of other states, and I think Ms. Richardson maybe provided me that information, kind of from every state. There's a lot of states that use all sorts of things, soil quality, income. North Dakota uses kind of a complex system with that. So anyway, it's a good point of discussion, and be nice to maybe get the ball rolling on something like this. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is amazing to hit that right on 650.
I appreciate that. And Representative Quam is interested in some of that. He's written one or two bills to try to get at that too, so I'd encourage you guys to work with him. I know Iowa, they look at, do they use CER in Iowa?
Something. Yeah, they're another one.
Crop equivalency rating, and that's what I've been hearing from folks too, is that, tax us on our ability to pay rather than the value of the asset, which we need to pass on to the next generation. Other discussion on the A38. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but maybe you can help me since I'm new to the ag credits and all that. Why was market rate originally even considered instead of something else? What's the historical? Just curious.
Mr. Hines, I want to take a stab at that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquim, are you asking why the study would have been done in 1991?
Representative Joaquim.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, I'm actually asking more why Minnesota chose the route to do it based on market value instead of some other.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquim, Minnesota system, all types of property use the same basis, which is market value, and there's certainly something to be said for, being able to be uniform in that matter, that every type of property we have uses basically that type of a system. I suspect that in lots of other states they have since decided that it wasn't really working for agriculture or something to that degree, and that's why many states have put in twists on market value that maybe take it totally away or partly away. And even in Minnesota we have the Green Acres program, which kind of gets at some of those same issues in that it takes ag property and values it something other than pure market value. So but Minnesota has, the other thing Minnesota has that most states don't ever do is a highly classified system where we have different classification rates, a very complex structure of those. So that gives us an ability to tax ag land at a lower, even valuing at market value, but taxing it at a lower rate than other types of property using the classification rate system. And I think that's probably what's been allowed us to keep this system when other states haven't. But this is mostly just thinking about things, not based on research. So.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hines, for indulging me. I also was wondering, maybe this goes to the author of the amendment, how would this interact with Article 2, Section 3 that's in the bill, which allows a second homestead on ag land, person's moved off the land or has found it within 10 years.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, you know, I think that is kind of a separate conversation, and I was kind of wondering a little bit, too, the same if somebody can claim a homestead on their farm and their else. I know I gave the example in committee where I talked to people who have a home in Moorhead but maybe farm out rural Blaine County, and so that was kind of my question. You know, can people claim, what's that going to do for one to the valuation of, you know, the assessors going out and valuing the property, but also are people then going to be able to claim property tax refund on both, you know, for the agriculture? You know, right now it's just, as I said, the house garage 1 acre, so if somebody has two homesteads, can they claim it on house garage 1 acre and their home in the city too? So, you know, I guess that would have to be worked out if that provision does become law, folks being able to claim two homesteads like that. So, I guess I'd kind of a wait and see, just based, I think more so based on what the results of that provision becoming law are versus, you know, what this would be. Because I kind of had that same question too. Will somebody be able to claim two property tax refunds, essentially?
Mr. Hines can have it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee and Representative Joaquin, currently, you know, in law we do have provisions called the Special Ag Homestead, where situations that we allowed for the land to be classified as homestead even though it's not contiguous with the property owner's home itself. And under those conditions, we don't allow that, you know, I guess we don't allow that to go into the PTR program. Those split parcels, they wouldn't be. So the little bit of change that we're making in this bill to that provision, opening it up for one more type of property to be considered a special ag homestead, I don't think would be allowed under this program under Representative Lee's language. And especially Representative Lee's language references a definition in 273.13 sub 23, which is the standard ag homestead circumstance, not the special ag homestead circumstance. So my guess would be that that would not come under this program, but I can't say with absolute certainty.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. More discussion on A38. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to kind of clarify that point a little bit, this amendment would only pertain to land that's contiguous to that house garage 1 acre, or contiguous to, to the house garage 1 acre.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dale.
One of the wonderful things about serving in the legislature is every day is new. And you get to learn about a whole bunch of stuff. And when I first took over the gavel you now hold, people started coming to me about egg values and land and property tax implications. And at that point, I think it's St. Cloud State does an analysis each year on farm incomes. And for the year previous, they just announced recently enough that even I was able to remember it. I think corn and soybean farmers' average income in the state was around $225,000 the year previous. And I thought, jeez! Well, if you think of the tax incidence study that we reviewed in full taxes a couple of weeks ago, that's beyond the 10th percentile. That's getting into the top decile. The top decile, that's probably getting into the top 5%, I'm not sure, but it's a pretty darn good income. And yes, there's property taxes and the like, but of course those are deducted before determining income anyway, so they're still doing pretty well. And so I thought, well, I don't know that we need programs to help people who are making $225,000 a year. Mr. Hines wisely counseled that I watch it a little bit, and that one of the challenges in working on a policy level on farmland valuations and the intersection with farm incomes is farm incomes tend to be a bit of a roller coaster. And in fact, if I remember correctly, last year's St. Cloud State University analysis had corn and soybean farmers down to about $40,000 a year, with the collapse in commodity prices had dramatically impacted these folks. And to, I can't imagine going from $220,000 one year to $40,000 in income 2 years later, but that's farming. I've got a friend who teaches actually ag finance to farmers out of the university through the Extension Service, and he says the smart ones tuck a little bit aside in the good days, and the ones who end up going out of business in the bad days often are the ones who didn't tuck anything aside when they have the good days. And they maybe spend a little more time in Arizona in the wintertime and spent the money there, and when the commodity prices come back down, they don't have the stuff behind them, the cushion underneath them to be able to handle it. So I'm intrigued with the lean proposal here being income sensitive. I think it does probably make projections for the state side of things more difficult, but it also means that we won't be subsidizing the $225,000 year when folks clearly have a lot of capacity to pay property taxes and the like. But when those commodities come down, gravity seems to have the same effect on commodity prices as it does anything else. When those prices come down, but the property taxes remain high or even continue to grow from there, they've got something. They know that Minnesota has their back. So I appreciate the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, other discussion on the 838. Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lean. I agree with Representative Dabney. Every day you learn something new here, and ag land is certainly not something that I'm very familiar with. We don't have a lot of that in the city of Duluth, but nonetheless, it's certainly an important issue for a lot of Minnesotans, so I do my best to try to understand it. But perhaps a question for either Representative Lean or some of the other folks on the committee that might have an answer, or perhaps you, Mr. Chair, I don't know. But when I look at this, and you wonder if what we're doing here is we're trying to, you know, solve a problem that certainly has a lot of merit, as you have done in your bill with the provision right before this. But my question is, and I hear this from time to time in the hallways and in my office about, you know, what is the property tax philosophy about ag land in comparison to, say, you know, how we do property tax policy on the Iron Range for taconite mining with a production tax? And I'm just curious if somebody can just enlighten me as a non-ag person what the ag folks think about perhaps, you know, some other form of tax policy, because this, you know, Representative Lean's provision certainly makes a lot of good sense to me, and I think I can support it. But I just wonder if discussions have been had in the past, or if there's a will or a movement out there to look at some other different type of tax on ag land. And I'm just curious, because I think that might perhaps influence my vote one way or the other. But I don't know, Mr. Chair, if that's just open it up maybe to the author or to anybody else who wants to answer.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from what I hear, when we had these meetings from farmers in Clay County, something I heard a lot about was folks felt the current property tax system as it results, or as it regarding ag property, is that it may be a little antiquated, I guess, for lack of better terminology. Basically that, you know, once when farming at a point, you know, many years ago was more based on kind of subsistence agriculture, that this was to be, you know, sort of considered property in the sense that maybe a homestead would be considered property. Whereas now, it's getting to the point where farmers, you know, course are actually making a business off of this. This is their income, you know, beyond just feeding their families and everything. So that's kind of the perspective I've heard from a lot from farmers, which kind of made me think, like, well, you know, maybe we should be looking at a value or an income or a production-based approach to assessments in ag properties. And as Mr. Hines and Representative Joachim were talking a little bit, too, about taking a look at what other states do for value, production, based assessments and how that came about, I started to think, you know, beyond more than just Minnesota taking a look at maybe how we can do this, you know, it'd be interesting to look at when other states started to move to this, you know, kind of the history of that in other states, and furthermore, what the impetus was for that progression to moving from the market value to the production value. So that's a little bit, I guess, what I hear from farmers as far as their kind of ground level perspective of this.
Other discussion on the A38 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm just briefly, I just want to explain, I was trying to talk to Mr. Hines to figure this out because I was getting confused. The amendment has a reference to the definition of the term homestead in 273.13, subdivision 23, and I was confused because that term is not actually defined as homestead, but Mr. Hines explained to me that that in the context of that subdivision that the that it's simply defining what an agricultural homestead is. In any case, I found myself confused by that. Maybe nobody else in the committee did, but I wanted to at least note in case you did, because Mr. Hines cleared it up for me offline. So, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. More discussion? Our members are ready to vote. We can go recruit the other members. Let me consent staff to do that. The electrons are flowing right now, so I guess that's happening.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dowdy.
Twins still up 5-3, top of the sixth now, two outs.
Probability is increasing. Oh.
Baseball is a game of statistics, Mr. Chair.
It is.
So is property taxes. So is property taxes.
Representative Markwood, I had a ballpark idea, but
you wasn't
sharing a lot.
Yeah, I think it's like 653 or it was in this report. I got it. I don't have it with me today, but I'll go and have you look at all the counties. You'd be interested.
Then, yeah, I was just starting off my extension career at that point.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I don't know for sure how Clay County lingered. It'll be somewhere in the middle. Yeah, it's 650, 652. Yeah, I'm impressed.
I wish it would have been a baseball in the bottom of the ninth. Representative Lucheski, we're eagerly awaiting your amendments.
You're waiting for someone to vote.
Well, we are, but
we're also
looking forward to your amendments.
You're on deck to use the baseball.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we're on baseball night.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for, I came up to the chair in Ways and Means and asked him if he would allow me to offer my amendments when I got here, since we were in Ways and Means, and so I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
We did the A16, yeah.
Paul, it's only 2:15. Knock it off.
What's that?
It's only 2:15. Go set me on it.
If you don't need it.
So members, we'll have the clerk take the roll on the A38.
I understand Rob Erickson's on the way.
Chair Driscoll.
No.
Vice Chair Quam.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Erickson? Representative Hertas?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
Yes.
Representative Lean?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Simonson?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Whalen?
No.
Representative Joaquin?
Yes.
Okay, the Representative Erickson's vote will not be consequential. The vote is 7-7. The amendment is not adopted.
Ooh, so that's
the. Is there another amendment? Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair. I would offer the A39 amendment. Should be on its way around.
Representative Simonson moves the A39 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and we had a long, long debate yesterday on the impact of reducing local government aid to cities of the first class. Well, maybe not all cities of the first class, but three cities of the first class. And we heard good testimony, we had good discussion, and I won't rehash most of that, which I'm sure you'll appreciate. But the point is, members, that beyond the politics of this and beyond the impact of tax increases and service cuts, the reality is that when we start to mess around with local government aid in this fashion, is that it really undermines the integrity of the program. And I think that was the nonpartisan testimony that we heard was, if you're going to do something, do it right, or don't do it at all. So what we're doing here in your division report, Mr. Chair, with Representative Quam's bill, is that we're really undermining the integrity of the local government aid program. Because if this were to pass and get signed into law, we're sending a pretty strong message to all cities, not just three cities that are affected by your bill, but all cities across Minnesota that, nothing is sacred. And at any point in time, legislature can come in and carve out a group of cities and pass along a cut to them or give them an increase without any really particular thought as to the process or to the value of the formula. And so with this amendment, Mr. Chair, members, is perhaps an opportunity to once and for all put the issue behind us for cities of the first class. Because what I heard Representative Plum talk about a number of times is that, you know, the aid given on a per capita basis is just too high. And we know now that that's not true, right? Because we heard testimony, we've seen data, and we know that the aid given on a per capita basis to Duluth, to Minneapolis, and St. Paul is not the highest in the state. So that's not the reason why we're cutting local government aid to Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. We still don't really have a very good reason, but this, Mr. Chair, this amendment takes us out of the equation once and for all and forever. And it eliminates local government aid payments to cities, all cities of the first class, including Rochester, all four of them, pulls them out of the local government aid program entirely. And that eliminates the concern from most cities about, you know, what their future looks like. It gives them an opportunity to do budgeting that makes sense based on projections that they know are somewhat secure. And it removes this ability for the legislature to constantly single out certain groups based on perhaps certain demographics or certain reasons. So that being said, you know, Mr. Chair, members, we certainly can't live without local government aid in those cities. We already have heard testimony about what the impacts of just reducing it by a certain amount is, and certainly total elimination would be nothing less than the destruction of the economic search engines of Minnesota, or search engines, economic development engines of Minnesota. So we need some revenue in exchange. And this amendment simply allows those first-class cities to retain the state sales tax revenues collected on sales and purchases within their borders and spend those monies on government expenses. So rather than remit that 6.5% sales tax back to the state of Minnesota to be dispersed fairly throughout the state, we'll simply retain those dollars within our own cities and use those dollars to supplement our general funds. So that's essentially the amendment, Mr. Chair, and I would stand for questions.
Would you like a roll call on that?
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would like a roll call.
Roll call's in order.
Thank you. Other discussion on the A39?
No,
that's it. That was the
call of constituents. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simonson, do you know, or does anyone know what the numbers are as far as the sales taxes generated in those three cities?
Ms. Dalton's reaching for the microphone. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, I don't know right now, but if you continue this discussion long enough, I will know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, and I will defer to Ms. Dalton when she gets accurate numbers, because I'm sure they're much closer. But I know that for the city of Duluth, in round numbers, to give you an idea, it's around $90 million. But that also includes the percentage of state tax that is constitutionally dedicated. And this amendment does not touch those dollars. So we'll have to see what they come up with an exact figure. But for the city of Duluth, it's in the neighborhood of that, a little bit less.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, apologies. In addition to everything else, I think a number of us have constituents coming to visit as well. So I was running out to say, got to run back in. So I appreciate this. I guess in many ways it feels like, given the cut in LGA, that it doesn't go far enough. I was looking at figures that in St. Paul, it's 10 times as much money coming into the state treasury from folks working in St. Paul, sales taxes, from other things, as St. Paul gets back in LGA. That may be the case for the towns represented by a number of us that we talked yesterday about how towns represented by a number of members of this committee have LGA per capita well above the figure, well above the amount St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth receive now, and certainly well above the amount that they would be getting.
I don't know if in the cities represented by all of you, those towns, that the amount that you're generating is 10 times as much money as you're getting from the state. It maybe may not be, but I know for St. Paul and these other cities that that is the case. And what I especially then like about this is the recognition of the economic tie. We talked a lot yesterday about the effect in each of these communities of these LGA cuts, but I think we also want to be thinking about the effects in the surrounding regions of these cuts as well. There would a healthy Representative Hertz is here, but a healthy Wayzata, a healthy Anoka, represented by Representative Whalen, a healthy Lakeville, Representative Kosnick, et cetera, depends on a healthy Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I'm very happy to say vice versa as well. The kind of cuts that are coming to these cities, that would be coming through this bill, would be cuts that would be devastating to the economies of these cities on top of everything else, and would then have a broader effect on the broader region and would hurt presumably sales taxes on those cities as well. Given that, the connection seems very clear to me, and I appreciate the amendment being brought up to make this tie-in, that in fact, if that's going to happen, well, at the very least, allow the cities then to keep the money generated in the cities. I don't know if, as I say, I think I'd like it even better if there were, if the other components of tax receipts in these cities were kept within them as well, as long as we're going to have these cuts. I want to say, if there were some rationale, some reason for saying we're going to whack these cities in this way, then I might say, well, okay, we have some understanding of that. But as long as we're simply going to say these cities, despite the agreed upon need and the agreed upon level of ability to pay and this resulting amount of money, we're simply going to not have them have the same receipts, the same funding that other towns and cities throughout the state get, it does seem to me at that point then, why would we not let these towns and cities receive, be able to keep the funds that are generated within them? I don't know if anybody has, if Representative Simonson has, figures sort of more broadly for sales taxes generated in these cities as compared with sales taxes around the state. But I think if we could somehow do an exercise where we're looking at sales taxes and economic activity generated not just within these cities, but as a result of having healthy cities like these, I think we'd find that a quite significant portion of our economic success as a state has been due to having these healthy, vibrant cities, which have cooperated and collaborated with cities across the state. So I appreciate appreciate what you put together here and pointing this out. I guess I continue to hope that that reason will prevail, and that we'll say that that a formula that that is apparently working well for lots of other cities, giving them per capita aid of more than $300 for many of us sitting around this table, and certainly above the amount that my city's receiving, that we would have that, we would reverse those, that, and if we're going to cut LGA, let's do it so it's in a fair way across the board. Absent that, if we are in a each city is in for itself kind of mentality and mode, then this does seem like a direct and appropriate, albeit very sad, way of doing so. And so I appreciate you putting it together. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do support the Simonson Amendment here, and I think it really is the least we can do if we are going to be cutting cities LGA on a, you know, really not a uniform basis. I think this is really the least we can do to ensure that citizens in those cities do get the same services that citizens in any other Minnesota city get, and at a, you know, as we've heard before, at a price that's affordable. You know, as I had said last night too, I had called up many cities regarding LGA increases and their levy increases and everything, and when I hear folks talk about having to put off projects or having to do projects that they just could not continue to put off and having to take out debts for that, now having to pay the debts and everything, really disturbing to think that we would be taking these funds from these cities without some way to at least give them some sort of option to replace those funds. So, you know, if we are going to charge ahead with cutting LGA from these cities, I think giving them some flexible options to replace that funding is the least we can do. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Winchester.
Mr. Chair, the microphones work, or should I just take them?
No eating and talking at the same time.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've only been down to the MnDOT cafeteria once this year, and I went today because I heard we're going to be on the floor at midnight with Gundo. And so I went down there and I got a sandwich.
It'll be a good night.
Yes, because so I figured I missed breakfast, and so this is, you know, this is it, because I don't think there's anywhere around here. You know, they closed that place where you can go out and get popcorn or something. So I think we're going to be here a long time. But, Mr. Chair,
there's an entrepreneurial opportunity there for somebody.
Yes.
It certainly is.
Uh-huh. Yes, and so I have to say on Representative Simonson's amendment, I'm struggling a little bit here because I hear what's going on here is the cities that are going to be cut by LGA are be left in the lurch here, so they're saying, hey, let us use this other mechanism, and yet, you know, I don't think this is necessary. I think what we should be doing is not cutting our LGA. So I'm in a little bit of a tough situation, but I, on the other hand, I hear what Representative Simonson is saying and Representative Pinto, and that, well, if we're going to just take, and you can see in the amendment how much money has gone out of the LGA formula then, it seems to me that, you know, all they're asking is to replace that revenue stream with other taxes their residents are paying. So, you know, I'm going to keep thinking about this. I don't think Representative Simonson, with this bill, should be put in this situation. I don't think his constituents should be put in this situation. And I don't think Representative Dabney and his constituents should be put in this situation, or Representative Pinto and his constituents. So, yeah, I think it's an unfortunate moment that we're even talking about this. So I'm going to continue to listen to the debate and try to decide if I want to vote no, because I don't think Representative Simonson should even have to be in this situation, or vote yes to kind of help him out as a last-ditch effort. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate we had a little parliamentary maneuvering in the K-12 committee with amendments having to be divided and roll calls and all of that, so I was out of the room longer than I wanted to. Representative Simonson, thank you for offering this, because it raises the conversation that we need to have about whether we're one Minnesota or not. Fact of the matter is, sales tax generated in the city of Minneapolis is $465,000 a year.
Million.
Thank you.
I didn't get the audience correct.
I guess it's that obvious that I need the help. So let me cast it over.
There's always
so we have a little parliament.
There's always a good support group.
There is. There is. You know, we don't get here alone. We don't operate here alone. $465 million generated just out of the city of Minneapolis dwarfs any aid that our city gets dramatically. Where does that aid go? Well, again, Mr. Chair, go back to the Aids and Credits publication of House Research. It flows out. It flows out to Greater Minnesota. So while this bill attempts to cut the LGA of St. Paul and Duluth and Minneapolis as some sort of savings, it still relies on the taxpayers of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth to fund the programs that the rest of Minnesota relies on. If you start looking at Chairman Chesky's hometown of Bloomington, actually my hometown as well, we actually went to the same high school. We don't talk about that much, but there have been over the years four of us.
Was that a bad high school? Represent down here.
Cheryl and Chesky.
Sorry, not to interrupt, but and we didn't go there together.
No,
we met each other here. But the club is former Representative Rude,
right?
Senator Hamm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Representative Thiessen grew up in Birmingham.
Yes, he did.
There's a whole bunch of people. Who am I missing?
Guy from up north.
Frank Moe.
Frank Moe. Thank you.
So, you know, Birmingham's fertile ground for future legislators.
Well, and Chairman Chesky, Mr. Chair, That was six members, I think. I'm sure the audience will correct me if I'm wrong.
Where's that Winchester?
Well, Mr. Chair forgot, you know, of course, there's all the obvious, John Henley, you know, Seagren, Kevin Glatz. Yeah. I mean, we could just go, keep going, people proper, but there's a lot of people in other districts who grew up in Bloomington.
Right, well, even if you just look at those of us who went to Bloomington Jefferson. Mm-hmm.
Old Jaguars.
Okay, let's go back to Bloomington. Where's that Devin?
Okay, thank you. Five out of the six, I think, who went to Bloomington Jefferson in prestigious West Bloomington, as the real estate agents used to call it, and I believe Chair Winchesky may still honor campaign literature, I'm not sure, are Democrats. Only Senator Hunt. So, fascinating. But if you rope in the sales tax that is generated in Bloomington, it's very clear that the economic engine of the state and the parts of the state that the rest of the state relies on for aid for their nursing homes, for aid for their cities, for aid for their schools, is the metro area, predominantly. And yet, while we are asked to give and give and give, the proposal here is to cut. To cut to kill the golden goose. To drive down the quality of life issues and the public safety issues that Ms. Cadoon identified as critically important to business. I think, you know, if you really don't want us, then let us keep our sales tax revenue and we'll be glad to give up the LGA. And we'll be better off. If you really want to reduce property taxes for hundreds of thousands of folks in the state, let's go with the Simonson Amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think perhaps we can hear from Ms. Dalton if she's got some numbers.
Ms. Dalton is ready. Thank you. Ms. Dalton.
And Mr. Chair, I was actually ready a few minutes ago. So they weren't stalling just for me.
That's a bad characterization.
They weren't stalling, Ms. Dalton.
reminiscing just for me. My numbers are based on 2013, so they will differ slightly from what Representative Dabney had for the city of Minneapolis. But for 2013, Duluth would have been about $88 million, Rochester $135 million, St. Paul $227 million, and for 13, Minneapolis $435
million. And the total? I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalton, I assume that includes just 6.5%. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, that is correct.
Representative Simonson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And you know, I'm going to appeal to the folks that are thinking twice about this, and I want to appeal to the folks, especially on their side of the table, because yesterday we went through some exercises about trying to convince you that, you know, these cuts to cities of Duluth and Minneapolis and St. Paul are going to be devastating. And what you see here, and as you've heard numbers put forward by Ms. Dalton, and I'll just focus on the city of Duluth here for a minute, is that we generate almost $90 million in sales tax for the state of Minnesota. And we collect around in the neighborhood of about $29 million in local government aid. So if we were to pass this amendment and it were signed into law, I mean, that would be a net gain for the city of Duluth for about $60 million. So we could virtually eliminate property taxes in the city of Duluth. That would be, you know, a big win for all of us, right? Because we would have no property taxes whatsoever in the city of Duluth. We could rely solely on sales taxes collected from revenues. But I think what this amendment does, or what it should do, is draw your attention as to the vitality of these regional centers and the importance of these regional centers. $90 million in the city of Duluth is collected from folks that make purchases there. And it's not just our residents. It's folks that come to visit. It's folks from neighboring towns, cities. It's folks from Wisconsin that come to Duluth and spend money. And then in turn, you know, we collect the sales tax and we send it on to the state of Minnesota for distribution into the general fund of all things, where it's fairly distributed amongst programs across all of Minnesota. So for some of you that seem to think that the city of Duluth or the city of St. Paul or the city of Minneapolis receives too high of a per capita amount on the local government aid formula, I encourage you to take a look at some of the other cities that we've identified that receive actually a higher per capita payment under the local government aid formula. And I think for the city of Duluth, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 113 cities that receive a larger per capita payment under the local government aid current formula, current law. And then I ask you to take a look at those communities and see what kind of sales tax numbers that they generate for the state of Minnesota. And I would bet you lunch that you won't find any one of those 113 cities that generates more sales tax revenue than any one of the four first-class cities. Any one of them. And the point is, members, is that we're all in this together. This is a one Minnesota thing. That's why this system works. You can't pick out one piece and say, so local government aid is bad because these three cities get too much money. You can't do that because it has an impact, has a trickle-down effect. We're all part of a greater system that includes this aids to cities. It includes county program aid. It now includes township aid. It includes all sorts of other aids that we have in current law. And we also have the sales tax provision here in Minnesota where all sales, you know, many sales outside of what's exempt is taxed at 6.5%. And that 6.5% comes back here to St. Paul and it's distributed out amongst all of us, amongst some of your communities. And it's a system that works together. And if we take one piece out of this system, it fails. You can't pull these kind of dollars that you're proposing to pull out of local government aid for Minneapolis and St. Paul, because it's going to have a negative effect on all of the surrounding communities. It's going to have a negative effect on all of us in Minnesota, whether you're in rural Minnesota or in the metro area. It won't matter because it's going to have this negative effect. So my purpose with this amendment was not to suggest that I thought that you would vote for it, but it was an attempt to really try to bring this thing back to center and say, look at what the value of these cities are. And now we've heard that, you know, St. Paul, Representative Pinto City, generates over $225 million a year in sales tax for the state of Minnesota. $225 million. Representative Pinto, how much do you receive in local government aid last year?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's about $65 million. I'll confirm that. If I got that wrong, I'll come back to it. I think that's right.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. So, St. Paul generates $225 million a year in state sales tax. And in exchange, they get $60 million in aid in local government, or $60 million in local government aid. And we're going to cut their local government aid, which in turn is going to reduce their ability to collect state sales tax. Why? Because services are going to decline. And when services decline, businesses disappear, businesses don't come, business doesn't open, sales go down, revenues go down, you see the trickle-down effect. This is a complicated system, and if we pull one piece out, the whole thing collapses. So I hope that we can come to some conclusion here and deal with this local government aid issue. And this perhaps is not the answer, okay? This is a half-baked solution. I admit that. This is not the answer, because giving the state of Minnesota $30 million in exchange, me keeping 90, that doesn't make any sense, because that's not fair to all of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's any other comments or not, but perhaps we should move to a vote.
Okay, can we have staff round up the...
Mr. Chair, can I just briefly...
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know, I've been struggling with this kind of for similar lines as Representative Winchesky, and I guess what I'm, here's my thinking is that
my city will get a lot more money under this if this goes through. And I'm inclined that if the cuts remain in the bill, then at the very least this should be going in. So I plan to vote in favor. But if the majority does support this being in the bill, I still plan to vote against the bill as a whole, recognizing that we are all in this together, and that really what should happen is we should be respecting the formula as a whole and the results thereof. So I want to make sure to note that for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Cummings, you're due for a report. Yesterday was a big day, and you know how big were the trucks that came in? And how many? And what was the yield, Mr. Cummings? What was the take?
Mr. Chair, yesterday was the tax filing date, and you know I do have to tell you that for the last 4 years I worked as legislative liaison, and now I work as tax policy manager. The folks at the Department of Revenue do implement the tax code as passed by this body, and I got to tell you that it does bring a lot of pride, especially when you know our busy season is the same time as the busy season. There's a lot of work that they do in order to try and make sure the tax code runs efficiently as possible. And this time is a really busy time of year for the Department of Revenue in order to make sure that everyone's receiving and paying the right amount. And that's something that I know that they take a lot of pride in order to make sure that people are paying the right amount, no more, no less. And So yesterday was a day that was especially busy for the Department of Revenue, but we're here to serve you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Cummings, thank you. We very much appreciate all the hard work you and Ms. Ng and the rest of your folks do. I'm just also interested in, you know, how big of a day it was, but we probably won't know. They're probably still adding them up.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know that it is a time in which we do receive a lot of different, lots of forms in the door. It's a time in which all of our people are working in order to make sure that they're, everything's opened and processed. So, our property tax director moved from the tax operations division. So she was the one who helped to take a lot of the inflow from many of the returns that would come in at this time of the year. Maybe she can give a little, what is it like in the tax operations division this time of the year? Ms. Raleigh might be a very good resource to try and give a little insight.
Well, that's a great idea, Mr. Cummings. Thank you.
Big service.
He's very helpful. Ms. Rowley, you know, you weren't a truck driver then.
I wasn't a truck driver, but I did empty some trucks.
You did? It was just a metaphor I developed. So tell us how it went, and maybe the inside workings of the gears and how they make everything turn out the way it's supposed to.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Cindy Raleigh, Director of Property Tax, but former Director of Tax Operations. Most people think yesterday is the big day, and actually today is the big day because the law requires tax returns to be electronically or paper postmarked by the 15th, which means the post office picks them up if they're paper and delivers them today, or the software companies like TurboTax and others electronically pass them through kind of all through the night last night, and they arrive today. So usually today is the biggest day of the year. Paper has been reduced pretty drastically, down to about 15% of what we receive. So what used to be a really big event today, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, actually is a lot smaller now.
So Ms. Raleigh, 85% electronic then, or no, there's probably some people hand deliver them or other?
About 85% electronic.
Okay. Wow. Well, thank you for the report, and good luck as you handle that big mountain of work and keep the gears going.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lincheski,
Mr. Chair, you
got a grin on your face. So
but no, are we stalling or what?
We're waiting for voters.
Right. Okay.
We can start.
Can I just ask a question unrelated to this vote?
Oh, certainly.
And maybe it's for when we, you know, as we move along. But, you know, there were some, you mentioned when we did the walkthrough that there were a few provisions that were never introduced as bills and never heard as bills. And I was wondering if we might have some discussion of those yet.
And we did have discussion when you were downstairs. We talked about the pipeline provision.
Yep.
And we talked about the public defender number change, and we talked about the local impact note change and how that's going to be handled differently with the Legislative Budget Office. And there was a little bit of discussion about the ag property tax being an income tax versus a property tax credit. So that was those were the ones I remember.
So now I know we're going to get ready for a vote. So, but maybe later after when we've done with amendments, we could go back to. I'm interested in, and they may have been built, but I don't remember them. Because I actually remember one day we were coming and going in like room 300, and I know I had Ways and Means, and everybody was coming on, so I might have missed them. But one is the prohibition of the Met Council to do debt for operating. Mm-hmm. Was that a bill?
No.
Okay, so that would be one some other time. Mm-hmm. And then the other was this whole sports facilities authority. Was that a bill?
No.
Okay, so maybe later we could talk about those two before we...
Sounds good. Actually, it looks like it'll probably be tomorrow at this point.
Okay.
Okay. The clerk will take the roll on the A39.
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Mr. Chair.
President Simons.
A quick question for staff, Ms. Dalton, more than likely, but as I'm looking at the bill, the amendment, the A39, I just want to make sure that on lines 119, 120, that what we're doing here is we're not reducing local government aid to any other city.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, now, what we're doing is we are taking it down to the amount of money that goes to the other cities other than the four first-class cities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
And thank you, Ms. Dalton. I just wanted to make sure that. So members, just before you make your vote here, make sure that you understand that. We're only reducing local government aid in its entirety to the four cities of the first class. 100% reduction. All other cities will stay the same under current law.
Thank you for the clarification. The clerk will take the roll on the A39 amendment.
Chair Drazkowski.
No.
Vice Chair Quam.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Hertas?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
Yes.
Representative Lean?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Simonson?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Whalen?
No.
Representative Joaquin?
Yes.
Okay, with there being 6 ayes and 9 noes, the amendment is not adopted. Members, our meeting tomorrow again is at 11 o'clock a.m. in room 500 South. And we are going to adjourn now until then. We plan to take a vote tomorrow, Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, in response to Representative Erickson's in my conversation between K-12 finance and here, the Twins are up 7-3, bottom of the 8th. So it's good.
Wow. The sun's getting brighter.
Yes, it is. Some of my Greater Minnesota members were wondering about Saturday. If we don't complete the bill tomorrow, do you see rolling over till Saturday, or will we allow those folks to go home, yourself included, I trust, and take up the bill and complete it on Monday? What's your intent?
As I mentioned, Representative Dabney, I intend to take a vote tomorrow. We have already heard this bill for 13 hours, and we have a good amount of time tomorrow. We've heard a pile of amendments. We've cussed and discussed that this bill, and we'll cuss and discuss it some more tomorrow, and then we're going to take a vote. And so that's the plan. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned until tomorrow. It's adjourned, and we'll meet again tomorrow at 11 o'clock.
Thank you.
Thank you.